This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time. I've been watching the current events unfolding in the past 2 weeks or so, specifically related to the anti-racism movements across the world. And I feel like I have an absolute responsibility as a woman of white privilege who has a podcast, who has a voice that a few people listen to say something and to contribute. And I know I'm not going to get it right. And part of that honestly really scares me. However, it is my responsibility with the voice that I have to contribute actively to the anti-racist sentiments and actions and beliefs that are happening across the world, and to support the people of color, the indigenous people, and definitely the black lives that matter in the world today. And so what I'm going to do over the next 4 to 6 weeks is to highlight some of the most prominent interviews that I've done with people who have been absolute anti-racist advocates through the work that they've done, and I want to just amplify their voices. And some of you may never have heard these interviews because they are from the very beginning of my podcast, and so my hope is that it may not be a repeat for you. But I think there's a lot of value in listening to their voices and listening to the voices through the lens of today's current events. There's a lot of wisdom here, and I hope that you enjoy. Today, I'd like to highlight the incredible work of Nadia Lopez. She is the principal and the leader of Mott Hall Bridges, an incredible school for students in Brooklyn. And I was so inspired by our conversation, which we had right around when the COVID-19 pandemic started. But I think some of her wisdom is still so very applicable when it comes to the respect that we show our students and the way that we can reinforce anti-racism and unity through this really challenging time. So I hope you enjoy our interview.
Thank you for the invitation.
I know that you are based in New York City right now, right at a time where this COVID-19 pandemic is really at the forefront. It is a crisis zone where you're at. And as a principal of this incredible school that you've built, I just want to know kind of what's going through your head right now in terms of how you move forward as a leader in this crisis.
It's a really great question to ask, Morgan. It's honestly, I don't really know if I'm moving any different than I would have if we didn't have COVID-19, simply because when you're grounded in creating a culture within a school which focuses primarily on the social emotional needs of individuals, which goes from the children, the staff members, and those who are in the community. It was just easy for me to go into the mode of how do we best protect our people and what do we have in place already that makes sense to onload remote learning, because that's how we have to provide instruction now without overloading folks. The mindset was, we have to do things in a way that's going to be transparent for everyone, the why that we're doing things, but also in understanding that it's going to be a time of significant change. And so what we did immediately, as soon as the schools were closing down, I already sensed that it was going to happen, just because people were getting sick. And I honestly didn't feel that there was a lot of clear information that was coming from the powers that be within New York City, and having a nursing background, I just felt like that it's just becoming too much. It's not sustainable the way people are getting sick and needing to go into the hospital. So it was very important for, as soon as Sunday they announced that they were going to be closing schools, that on Monday, when they kind of said, you know, we want everyone to be outside of the school buildings until Tuesday, when staff members can come back to actually start implementing some of the transitional work that's needed for kids to go online. We took that as a pause for the rest of the world, but as a team, we needed to get on a phone call. So we did video conference through one of the platforms, and we basically just identified, what do we have already in place? What online services are we already having the scholars work on? How can we translate that into Google Classroom? How many scholars have their email addresses? And so it, like, all of everyone on my team had an answer for every question, and it made it so much easier, that literally, like, if I could have recorded the Zoom conference, it was like a get together at brunch or something. Like, we had such a good time doing it, and created actionable steps, so that this way, when Tuesday came, all of the team leads gathered their teams and started rocking and rolling. Like, there was really nothing we had to, like, sit down and hammer through. Everyone got started. And so that allowed myself, and right now the acting principal of Mott Hall, because I'm on a medical leave, ironically. I was in the building with them. She literally was able to get things going. She was able to answer emails and be able to respond in real time. And I think more of the chaos didn't come from the school itself. It came from outside, because there was, you know, now we're part of a larger system that's trying to create protocol for 1,700 schools. And so we were putting things in place, but then, you know, you come across, like, there's so many demands that's coming at us quickly, where folks may not be thinking in terms of, okay, this works for the larger system, but our community is distinct from another school system, another school community. So the needs in Brownsville, whether it's the scholars who are in temporary housing, the scholars with mental health needs, the scholars who are living with the grandparent, you know, the issues of poverty, and in a community that has so many social emotional needs, you just can't say, okay, if we put kids online, they'll be fine. It was a matter of, so how do we make sure that every child can get online? But if they can't, what's the plan B? Plan B, every single scholar needs to have packets, even if they have a computer at home. Because the reality is that there's some scholars who may need additional work. There's some scholars who may have a handheld device but don't have Wi-Fi. And so we couldn't take a chance. We had to make sure everyone was prepared. And then for those scholars who need to get support services like guidance or some type of therapy, how do we continue on with those services? And so there were a lot of moving parts. But as I said, because of the culture that was already in place prior to COVID-19, my staff was able to do miraculous work in 24 hours.
Wow. And I mean, that really, there's so many directions I could take this right now. And I think, just since we're on this topic right now, how are you managing some of the needs, say, of your those kids for which you really need to tackle that diverse approach to learning, that differentiated instruction? If there are learning disabilities, if there are, you know, I mean, cognitive delays, any of that kind of stuff, how are educators able to meet those needs? And then if you're talking about social emotional learning, are there counselors or are there educators reaching out one-on-one daily to kids, or what does that actually look like for those of us who are just at the infancy stage of this online remote learning?
So when you talk about the needs of the scholars who have individualized education plans, or even the ones that we consider to be at risk, who mm-hmm. probably need to be classified, but, you know, parents have to accept and be willing to have their children tested. We had already identified those scholars. So that was part of the conversation as well, right? Because immediately you start thinking about how families don't have the capacity of supporting their children. A lot of our parents are illiterate, have not graduated middle school or high school. So there are a lot of gaps in terms of the parents being able to support their children at home. So we identified who those scholars were. Our paraprofessionals are amazing. In other states, they may be considered, they are known as teacher's aides. Mm-hmm. They have all of their scholars' phone numbers. So what was immediate was within Google Classroom, there were going to be, if they were part of a larger group, then they would have small groups where there was video conferencing to support them with instruction. If children didn't have the means to be online, their parents more than likely have the ability to, you know, a cell phone that we can call them and talk them through the problems, or do like a FaceTime or a WhatsApp call where they can visually see the scholar and walk them through problems. We have also begun to utilize YouTube, because regardless if children have access to online in terms of being able to get to Google Classroom, if they don't have a handheld device in terms of a laptop, it makes it really difficult to be able to communicate on Google Classroom in terms of uploading stuff. But they all have access to YouTube. Hmm. And so we have a YouTube channel, which would allow us to create a closed link that's only accessible to our scholars, where teachers can perform live chats and conversations with our scholars, but also creating, we have a library of videos that they can tap into for instructional purposes. So for every unit that is online now, there are mini lessons that the teachers have recorded. So the 3 days that we were in the school building, teachers literally were recording their mini lessons and uploading them.
Amazing.
So this way the children have, yeah, they have visuals, like step by step from the teacher, in the anticipation of what the child may struggle within the video. So academically, and we're really strong on when it comes to our special needs, because we have 32% of our population as special needs. But if they all had to be evaluated, I would say we're closer to 65-70% of our scholars with special needs. So
wow,
we're constantly trying to figure out differentiation and making sure things are accessible for all of the children. In terms of how are they getting supported, because we have such a high demand and for emotional needs when it comes to the children we serve, we had already in place what's called champions. And so for every 10 scholars in the building, 10 to 12 scholars, there's one champion for them. And that was really important to me. I put that in place, I want to say 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, because when we did a survey, and one of the surveys came back with the question, we rated low when the children said they didn't feel like there was someone who they could go to, or there wasn't a designated adult that they felt that they could go to. And so I decided that we needed to create champions where every child has someone who checks in with them and is responsible for them for the entire year. And many of the kids have the same champion for 3 years. So it's not based off of grade level. It's just based off of grouping. So that same child will have the same champion for 3 years. And so every champion is responsible to call their scholars. So Monday is the designated date, because that's the day that they would check in with their scholars. We were in school, there's a certain time in the afternoon before school ends that all champions meet with their with their groups of scholars. And so now what we did was there's an hour set for the end of the day where all teachers are making phone calls and checking in with the scholars. And for scholars who we feel have a significant amount of needs, they're called multiple times by multiple adults. So even though I could be a champion of, let's say, I'm going to say a child name is Vanessa. So if I'm Vanessa's champion, mm-hmm. however, Miss Morgan also has a relationship with Vanessa, Miss Morgan is going to call Vanessa as well, just because one, we want that child to know that they are awesome and important to us. Second, we want the family to know that this is what's required in order to make sure your child is good. Mm-hmm. And three, we just need to make sure just overall that when change like this happens, that children don't feel that the disruption means that they're insignificant and not valued.
Wow. That is so concrete and so, so, so powerful. We don't have anything like that in place currently, but I almost think if there's a silver lining to all of this, that it will really compel us to create systems like this so that we can connect with those kids. I mean, even in the best of times, what a wonderful thing to be doing. It's a beautiful practice. And I love how you're doing that in a very real way now. Are educators in front of their laptops all day, Monday to Friday? Or how does that look in terms of their practice, their instruction, their connection mm-hmm. with their students?
When it came time to create this schedule, what I wanted to really be mindful is that being in front of a computer is very, very stressful mm-hmm. if that's not what you do. So, you know, you go into the tech industry. I've visited Facebook, LinkedIn, and Google. And it's really eye-opening how casual the space is, yet it's still productive. Because adults are able to, you know, choose when they want to be in front of the computer, choose when they want to have meetings, choose when they want to take a step back and engage in some type of self-care. Like there's even pods inside of these offices, right? And then there's like chefs and things that prepare their food. And so we don't culture of being in front of a computer all day, but we do have a school where that says you're in front of children, but you do have prep periods and you do have your lunch. And so in creating the schedule, I worked with the principal in place, who was my assistant principal prior to me leaving. And so every teacher has a block period of teaching. So for instance, English has 8 to 9:30. And so if that English teacher is on from 8 to 9:30, the expectation is we do the same for the teacher that we do for the scholar. So the teacher is on from 8 to 9:30, but the scholar is able to go on anytime between 8 and 9:30, mm-hmm. Just so that they're not overwhelmed because they have to sit longer than the adult. But the adult after, let's say, 9:30, will then from 9:30 to, let's say, 11 o'clock will engage in choosing to do some type of self-practice where they are perhaps doing meditation, engaging in some type of quiet time. Maybe they're reading leisurely. I've pushed them to make sure that they are incorporating self-care, even though they are focused on instruction as well. And then after they have their self-care time, which can be like 45 minutes, they then go back online just to check scholars' work, maybe follow up with parents, talk to the paraprofessional, check in with the guidance counselor. And that's going on until about 12 o'clock. From 12 to 1, everyone has lunch. So in our building, when the scholars have lunch, all of the adults have lunch. So we don't have staggered times. Everyone goes to lunch at the same time. So after 1 o'clock, 1 to 2, that teacher may be engaging in professional development or having a team meeting. So we would have ELA team meetings and or they're engaged in a specific professional development. And then at 2:30, depending on the day, from 2 to 3, they're doing champions. If not, they're on a call. So every single day we have a check-in call as an entire team to talk about any challenges they've experienced. Even though we have a message board through Microsoft Teams where they provide feedback about how their day has gone or if there's any challenges, but just overall, we get to have what's called kids talk. So teachers can share, let's say Jonathan didn't come online today. Another teacher would say, well, Jonathan was in my class. And then another teacher would say, Jonathan was in my class as well. And then the guidance counselor did call Jonathan's mother. And the problem is that Jonathan is not getting up on time. So we're incentivizing a program so that Jonathan can get up, you know, or what we need to do. We realize that some parents are just like, it's just too early and I'm not waking up as early to get my kid ready. And we have to be cognizant of that. So we've also had to just discuss if Jonathan gets online and has been participating with two other classes, how flexible can we be that Jonathan completes what he didn't complete in the first period class, that he can at least have until, let's say, 6 o'clock in the evening to get something done, and that you'll still be able to check to see that he did it and give him feedback, because we know the type of families we're dealing with and the lack of support. And that's why this time is very crucial for the scholars, because we provide the discipline and structure that they need. And they look forward to going to school because someone is on top of them having higher expectations than someone at home.
Love it. And I really thank you for that really specific kind of outline of the day, because I think it's super helpful to just to have a sense of how other people are doing it, because there are so many different models all around the world right now for what education could and should look like. What are you saying? I mean, I'm sure you have a network of fellow educational leaders, principals who you are reaching out to. And I know that you've had your own, through your leadership journey, you're such a passionate person. I've learned a lot about you online. I've seen you talk, you know, on numerous interviews. And I know that the leadership journey has taken you on a self-care journey as well. What advice do you have for principals in this time?
Yes.
In terms of taking care of themselves and how they can, it's kind of a double-pronged question. It's like, how do you lead effectively with strength and with integrity and with trust, but then also take care of you as a person underneath all of that?
Well, that's interesting because especially since I have been out on leave because of stress-induced kidney disease I developed. And so for the past 8 months, I've had the time to really sit down and be in the stillness. So where everyone is being still and like losing their minds, I'm like, imagine what it felt like for me at a time when it was like around when school was ending and it was graduation and prom, and I couldn't attend any of those events, right? It was devastating to me. But I also realized that I had to get better. And the only way I could do that was to be away from the space. And so with that, I've recognized that there are certain things that we have to put in place. And also be in a position of being transparent and vulnerable with our team. And I've always been that way. I've always shared like when things aren't going well, when I don't have the answer, when I'm overwhelmed, I'll tell my team like this is an overwhelming time. There's a lot to be expected. But in me saying that, I was always still putting people first. And so what I've developed for myself, which is something that I share with others, is the importance of scheduling your time. Because when you schedule your time, you create boundaries for everyone else to know, I cannot do this because I have a schedule. And this is important because I need to create balance. This past 2 weeks, like I felt so exhausted. I put a post up that said like at 4:58 a.m., I was up crying because literally my body, I was taking on so much. And then when I looked at my calendar, my schedule, I realized that I hadn't engaged in any self-care practices. And so that's where the imbalance was coming from. That's where that emotional spinning was coming from, because I hadn't placed it anywhere. And so that same day, I made sure to do exercise with my daughter. So we found a couple of free videos on YouTube, and we did like a Zumba class, and then we worked on abdominal work. And so I've now had to say, okay, I have to literally stop myself and do self-care. And so that's why it was, that's why for our schedule with the staff, I had to tell them, you have to stop and you have to be intentional about those practices, because it's so easy for people on the outside to say the work is still going to get done. Like, you don't have to stress yourself out. But the reality is that we know every minute that our scholars are not in front of us can be the detriment for their future. And so there's a lot hanging on the work that we're doing, because if the children aren't in an affluent household, they're not getting supplemental support, right? It's easier if, like, my daughter's home from college and, you know, she's able, she has greater experiences and she's disciplined that she can work on her own. She doesn't require me to sit with her and get everything done. I'll check in and ask how she's doing, but she's pretty much independent. The children that we're serving, the only time they get an adult who understands the work that they're doing and shows that they have an ability to hold them accountable is when they're in school. And so as leaders, we have to be mindful that we have the responsibility of making sure children are doing well, but then making sure that our team is successful, because they're overwhelmed. Right. Mm-hmm. And then there's never any space for us to say, I don't get it. I don't know how to do this. Because the minute that happens, everyone is like, what? If you don't get it, how am I supposed to get it?
Right. Right. Right.
And that's why I say it goes back to culture. Because if, for those who are listening to this podcast episode, what I'm going to say is, if you didn't have a culture in your building in which you were candid with your team, in which you checked in with them and made them feel valuable, in which that when you take risk or something happens, that everyone knows that you are gonna make sure that they're taken care of, but you just need time, then you have done a disservice. And that's something that you need to work on as soon as you get back to your building. I mean, you need to work on it now, but it needs to be a priority, because a lot of times folks can't give you what they don't feel you're giving. So like my team, they're graceful and gracious enough to say, like, their anxiety is just the fact of, am I doing this right? Am I going online? But they're not concerned with, it's going to be punitive. Like, if it's not perfect, someone's going to come and evaluate them and make them feel like they're not successful. Mm-hmm. And every school is not doing that. It's just like, this has to work. You have to get it done. And I'm like, listen, this has never happened before.
Yes. So
there's no wrong to this right now. There's no wrong. So I would just say that. I would say that it really comes down to the transparency and being able to say, no, I need to take a pause. Like, I took responsibility of the math team. Every single morning, I text them as a whole. And then throughout the day, I'll check in with them individually. Like, how are you doing? Have you taken time to breathe? Are you drinking water? You know, like, mm-hmm. all of those things. And as a result, they'll reciprocate it. They check in with me. Miss Lopez, did you drink water today? Did you get some rest? Because they also know, like, they want me to be okay. They're like, we don't want you to be stressed out. We don't want you to overexert yourself. Please take care of yourself. I'm like, I'm good. I'm all right. Thank you. And that's been helpful.
Yeah, big time. And I just think that's such a brilliant approach, Miss Lopez, because I think so many educational leaders miss that really, really important piece. I love that you said that about you can't give what you're not getting. And I think as leaders, often what you say, what you do is proportionately more valuable or more, maybe not valuable, but it really does set the tone for culture. People look to you and they're going, well, what do we do? And so if they see a positive example, you're more likely to see more of that in your building, which is wonderful. I usually do a rapid fire three questions on my podcast, and I again want to be very mindful of your time. I just want to touch very quickly on what is your overall message to students in the spirit of sort of helping them to feel their feelings, in the spirit of hoping to alleviate some of the trauma that's being created, because this is an incredible moment for collective trauma right now. And how do we come out of this? How do we come out of this together, unbroken? Do you know? What is your message to those scholars, to those students?
I've been messaging to my scholars that they are brilliant, and the circumstance that we're under is not their fault, but it's a time for them to really shine and take everything that they've learned this far and apply it to what they're doing online. And I think that overall, that's the most important message for them, because children at the age of middle school have such a finite way of thinking. And, you know, a lot of them are worried about what does this mean? What does this mean for them in terms of going to the next grade? We have those seniors who are graduating who potentially won't have a graduation or prom. And so this is much bigger than just COVID and staying home. It's like a milestone that for many of them has been taken away. And so reminding them of how significant they are beyond events, but in our hearts, has been so important.
Mm-hmm. That's powerful. Is there anything that you want to add before we get to those rapid fire questions? Anything that you think is really important that we've missed?
I would dare to say that I hope that from this, we all learn to be kind to one another. And we are open to listening, empathetic. I think that sometimes we've taken, we lack consideration for each person at each level, depending on the school that you're in. So, I was on Twitter the other day and I saw so many teachers on a particular tweet where they were just like, has anyone from your school contacted you to see how you were doing? And then it became this free fall chain of so many teachers saying no one checked in with them. And so I went online and I said, you know, I want to thank the educators, and it's our responsibilities as leaders to acknowledge the people who are doing the work for us. Right. And they need it and they deserve it. But at the same time, folks need to be just cognizant of how much stress and expectations have been put on leaders of school buildings to make sure things are up and running and, you know, all these systems are in place and compliance is completed. It's as much as the teachers have a great undertaking and they're responsible for, you know, let's say, depending if you're elementary, you're responsible for 30 kids. If you're in high school, you have 120 kids. But when you're the principal, you're in charge of hundreds to thousands of kids and then adults. And so we just have to make sure that in this time, thank you goes a long way. How are you doing? And listening to the answer goes a long way. And saying I appreciate you is always valued.
Thank you so much. My goodness, I'm so grateful to be talking to you, honestly, right now, because I think, man, you bring so much clarity and wisdom, so much wisdom that puts me at ease. So I can just imagine how you do that for the people who work with you, your team. In a few words or less, what does kindness mean to you?
Willing to give and being open.
What is one skill or superpower that an educator needs to lead with in order to be effective?
Compassion.
And finally, what quote or message would you print on one of those quote cups that could be sold in bookstores around the world?
Be great.
Miss Nadia Lopez, thank you so, so much for joining me today on Kindsight 101. It's been inspirational and honestly heartening to talk to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
And where can people find you if they want to get more?
They can follow me on any of my social media platforms at The Lopez Effect. It's one word. I'm on LinkedIn as well. And I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Lopez Effect. And I have two books out. One is The Bridge to Brilliance, which shares my story and journey of opening up a school, but just entering the education field and navigating all of the politics that comes with it. And then the other one is Teaching in the Fourth Industrial Revolution, in which I am a co-author, and that that provides models of success that actually aligns to what's going on today. How do you teach children skills that they need in order to be successful in the 21st century? That goes beyond the classroom. So we do a lot around the things that people should have been preparing for in order to be online and to collaborate and critically think and be creative. So those are two references if people want to go out and get those books.
Wonderful. Thank you so, so much for taking the time with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me again.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating a kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag smallactbigimpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.